Okay, so good evening. Tonight we're discussing chapter 18 of the book Letting Go, which is entitled Big Meaning. This chapter came about from a class that I held in an old dojo in Germany some years ago. And when I came in to teach the class, the students were all standing around jabbering. Some of them were not on the mat yet. And finally, about 5 minutes after we were supposed to begin, I had to ask the teacher to go tell them to sit down so we could start the class. And that's what prompted this chapter. And you might notice that in the beginning of the chapter, there's quite a bit about what I'm calling big meaning or true value, and how that really comes about in our lives. And then the meat of the chapter is about the three levels of breathing. In fact, this is the chapter in the book in which I've chosen to discuss key breathing most thoroughly. I think it's mentioned in other places, but it's never really detailed like that, as it is in this chapter. And there's a reason for that, of course, which I hope will become evident by the end of this evening. You know, our relationship with the teacher and with the teaching and with the dojo and with our fellow students and with our friends and loved ones and with our vehicles and our pets and our everything is based on respect. But in society, we have a rather warped idea of respect, because we think there's a subject and object, because we think that that you're over there and I'm over here. Then we think that respect has something that when I respect you, I'm doing something to you. Or like, when I respect the bouquet before I pick it up, I'm doing something to change the bouquet. But that's superstition. That's not true. I cannot do anything to change you, and I can't do anything to change the bouquet. Everything that I do or perceive or practice in my life, as with every one of you, is what makes my life what it is, for good or ill. That's why we can't complain when somebody else isn't acting the way we want them to act. So this is a to me, really important chapter, if we can understand what I'm talking about in terms of respecting. Of course, in the beginning, when we learn to follow etiquette, we learn to respect the implements in the dojo. We respect Suzuki Sensei's weapons. We don't use those. They're specially sacred, respected. We respect the teacher. We respect just the dojo itself. We bow a lot. We keep an attitude that's open and generous-hearted and filled with loving kindness all the time, and so this is all wonderful. But this is keiko practice. I mean, this is rudimentary. This is parochial practice. Any fool can practice that way. Please do. But sooner or later, we have to begin to understand what Toi Sensei means when he says the essence of our practice is to recognize this oneness, this non-separation, this not-to, this sokufuri. No connection, no separation. Very mysterious. It's only mysterious because we believe that the world is made up of many, many objects. And we think that by respecting those objects, they will treat us better. And that way we'll become happier and more fulfilled, more respected, more loved people. So this is a very selfish way to go about conducting ourselves. All right, let me read something from the chapter I think would be good. I'm starting not at the beginning of the chapter, but on the second page, 210. Quote, I want you to recognize and appreciate the value of life. How you treat the world around you is how it treats you. When you take care and do everything in front of you as if it is sacred, then indeed it is. In this way, you live a blessed life. You live a life that is whole. We call this being one with the universe. This is being not separate, not isolated, and hence not suffering. When you are sitting or preparing to train, prepare as if you are going to your beloved. If you don't take life for granted, it will not take you for granted. This is a mystery here that must be discovered. If you make light of something or treat something as habitual, then that is shrinking the meaning for you and creating a life for you that is inconsequential. How can you expect to move to the most refined level of consciousness when your habit is to minimize everything till the lowest level, the habitual level? Maybe you can understand this and improve your practice. Next is page 216. Someone recently asked me what nirvana is, and if this key breathing with no distraction can be called nirvana. What we call nirvana is simply what we experience already with the added key of a heightened state of awareness. Because of this awareness, the frequency of mental vibration is very intense and fine. Nirvana is this very life experience with no added resistance to what arises for us. This means that we accept everything as it is without the distinction, without the distraction of needing to alter it in any way. Every time there is the slightest distraction from this state, it is like dropping a big boulder into a pond. As the distractions become less and less, the pond of your mind becomes more and more still. Then not only can you see a clear reflection on the surface of the pond, but you can see deeply down into it. Even 15 minutes of undistracted key breathing will create this mind state, though it may take many years to reach this level. That's why it is important for you to practice every day. Learning about key breathing is an opportunity. If you didn't hear about this, then you would have no opportunity. The only way you can understand this is by practicing it. I have expressed before that you are all in trouble now, because now you have been told. Now you have a problem. In Tibet, they have a saying, perhaps it is better never to begin, but once begun, better to finish. Obviously, I want you to practice because this couldn't have happened for me if I didn't do that, and I want you to share this. If my teachers hadn't told me to do key breathing, then I wouldn't have done it. And if I hadn't done it, then none of this could ever have come to be. This is not just for some people. It's for everybody. And the last is on page 221. We have a structural mind. The individual shoga, or relative consciousness, is made of repeating relative structures. So naturally, they are going to keep arising and arising and arising in thought form. We don't fight against that, because that just creates more disturbance in the mind, as you've probably noticed. Just think of a thought arising as a key test. When you take a key test, you are fully aware of the person testing, and you welcome them. But you don't become distracted by this. Just like in a key test, you don't do anything with the experience, you just let it be. You may feel like following that thought that arises, and if you do, then very quickly you will be on the other side of the world, just like that. If we follow some random thought, then we're gone. So just don't go. Don't follow. Simply put, it is maintaining your integrity and not letting the thought or impulse take that away from you. But at the same time, you must recognize that the thought is a part of you. It is not a foreign thing, and so not a bad thing or a good thing. Part of you is going to want to make you get rid of this thought because it is interfering. It is distracting you, and you're supposed to be the super breather or the super meditator. Forget that. Just keep one point. Don't go against the thought and don't follow it. Just let it arise. In a way, it's very much like vapor. It comes, and you can see it, but if you just allow it to sit there in the warmth of your awareness, then very soon it's gone. In moments like these, it helps to have this breathing pattern to follow, because you will forget and follow thoughts. When that happens, and you suddenly realize you have gone away, then just come back to your breathing. Just come back. Don't criticize yourself, no matter what happens. Each time, we just come back to the breathing. If someone interrupts us, don't say, "I'm doing my breathing now, don't interrupt me." No. Just take care of what they need, then come back and sit down and continue breathing as if nothing happened. Everything needs a beginning. That is the most difficult point. Once you get the momentum up and running and establish a regular routine, then it begins to become so much easier. Don't think that you will wait to begin this practice until you are older and better prepared. There is no reason for you to say that you should be more prepared then than you are right now. You must begin as soon as you hear about it, without hesitation. This is respecting life, valuing this life experience for what it is. This is your chance. If you disrespect this, maybe you are disrespecting this whole life opportunity. So in this, I mention about integrity, which I'd just like to say a couple of things about before we open for questions. In our society, we tend to think of integrity as the ability of someone to follow a set of rules, moral compass, they call it, or a code. President Bush had a word for it, core beliefs. This is your moral code that you're supposed to adhere to. And if you do so, then they say, they will tell you, you have integrity. This is not integrity. This is just being a slave to a code of beliefs. Integrity, as I mentioned in here, in my experience, at least, is being true to our birthright, which is not to be a certain way. There isn't any looking at that from the outside and saying, you must do this and this and this and this and this. Again, this is not respecting others and not respecting yourself to try to do that. You know, everybody has different belief structure. Everybody has a different set of conditioning in their past. And you may have different, moral beliefs about how you think it should be. Maybe some is a Christian, some is a Buddhist, some are Muslim. Some of them don't have any belief in that way at all, so then your code is something else. But it's all belief. So that's fine. Whatever you want to cling to or hang on to or use to guide you in your life, that's fine. Just understand, that's not what I'm talking about, and it has nothing to do with this practice. This practice is amoral. Completely. It's not immoral, it's amoral. It has no moral context to it at all. There's no belief. We're talking about actually practicing. Actually practicing simply means being in the present with full awareness. Right? The practice is to be in the moment with as much awareness as possible. So this, if we're practicing, then we're exercising our integrity. And if we are not practicing, no matter how good a person we are in society's eyes, or in our friends' eyes, or our loved ones' eyes, it has no meaning, ultimately, for you. When you die, that will go away. It has no meaning. Finally, it can have a huge impact on the way your life progresses. That's true. But ultimately, it's not the point. And because it's not the point, it doesn't end suffering. And that's the problem. The practice is to put an end to our suffering. And as long as we are attempting to fulfill a certain idea about how to be, we will definitely meet opposition. And that might be trying to steal your neighbor's wallet, or it might be trying to give your wallet to your other neighbor. But in either case, there will be opposition arising from within or without. And as a result of attempting to carry out an action and meeting opposition is what we call suffering. So similarly, if we have the desire, in Russia, several students asked me about happiness. They seemed to be very concerned with happiness. Can this bring happiness, this practice? And I had to tell them no. If you want happiness, you will have to take pain, because that's the other side of happiness. When you go for happiness, sometimes you will get happiness, sometimes you will be disappointed and you'll feel pain. And even when you get happiness, it won't last. And you'll have to go work harder to get more happiness. And no matter how much happiness you get, it's never enough. It's the hungry ghost syndrome. You need more and more and more. There's never enough money to satisfy a greedy person. So, I wanted to make those points tonight about respect and about integrity, because that's actually the core of this, or the essence of this chapter, even though most of it's about key breathing. The reason that key breathing is in this chapter is because how to learn to maintain your integrity is how is to practice key breathing, key meditation, because when we do those help us build our capacity to be in the moment in attention, which is maintaining our integrity. So that's why breathing is such an important part of this chapter. Okay? So, now, if you have questions, please ask me.
What do you mean by happiness? What do you mean by happiness?
You mean, what did the Russians mean by happiness?
Yeah.
I have no idea what they meant by happiness.
Well, what was your explanation of what you thought they meant by happiness? I mean, you said that happiness is something that you necessarily have to keep chasing, and once you get it, you need to get more and more of it, which doesn't quite fit.
Seems the like Dalai Lama says, people in the West always ask me about happiness. The logical inference is that they're unhappy. Otherwise, they would not be asking me about happiness. We have in our mind an idea of happiness, and we experience it fleetingly, here and there. Some times in our life, we have much more of it. When a new baby is born, for instance. I mean, you know, that's something we're experiencing right now in my family. And then sometimes someone that you care about passes away, and then you have a little time of unhappiness. The two go together. You can't have one without the other. So what I meant by saying, no, this teaching doesn't bring you happiness, is that it doesn't bring you something temporary. And if it did, I wouldn't be selling it. I wouldn't be practicing it in front of you, because I don't want only that. It doesn't mean that I don't enjoy life. It doesn't mean I don't have happiness or pleasure and pain. Yeah, that's all there. But that's going to be there for everybody all the time, no matter what. It's the relative world. It's 50% of everything. So the practice is to learn to experience whatever it is completely without resisting it. Right? And this gives us a sense of fullness and completeness, but I won't call it happiness because of the, it's the semantics, of course.
Semantics.
But I won't call it happiness because of the way we use the word happiness in English or in all languages. Everybody, they have, you know, Allegro in Spanish, and they have another one in Russian, another one in German, but they all societies are the same. Everybody is clinging to a way to be. That's why The Secret is such a successful book, because she says, you can be happy. You deserve to be happy. You can chase this happiness dream, and it will fulfill you. Just manipulate your life in this way, and you'll have a happy result. Everybody loves that. And it'll fade away in a few or three years, because 2 or 3 years, everybody's going to go, oh, nothing changed. So, that's why I said what I did about happiness. Yeah, it's a very, it's a good question, because, you know, what do you mean by that? You know, what do you mean by that? And the way that they asked me the question, it was quite clear what they were talking about. Can't I find happiness through my work? Can't I find happiness through my, you know, relationships? Can I find happiness? Can I find happiness in Aikido? This kind of happiness. I'll say one more thing about that. You know, it is important to have a plus mind. You know, if you are negative and complaining and not accepting how things are all the time, of course, you're going to be very unhappy. And the more you can accept what happens, the easier it's going to be on you. But when it's a very painful thing, I wouldn't stretch it to say it makes you happy to accept it, but it gives you, you have a sense of completeness, of fullness, that is not, can't be obtained through any, through the acquisition of affection or money or goods or people. You know, I talk to people all the time that are very successful, and it's very revealing. There's never enough. Jeff and I went to visit a client of mine in Connecticut. He has 5 cars that are over $700,000 or $800,000 each. Some of them over $1 million. He doesn't even drive them, and he's buying 2 more. I said, "What are you doing? You can only drive one." And he said, "It's not about the driving." And he'll just have to keep buying more. You know. He can afford it, so that's fine. You know, I'm not criticizing him, but I learned something that day. A little deeper. Oh, yeah, right. So, okay. Mark?
The Shokshu tonight talked about the supreme ecstasy. Can you differentiate that from just very, very happy?
Not objectively. I'm not sure what you're asking me there. To provide for you, because I can't do it from the outside in. When you experience what Toi Sensei refers to as the supreme ecstasy of being one with the universe, then you know the difference between that and very, 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 very happy. Very, very happy is gleeful. You got your way. You got the thing you wanted. You've just fallen in love, or you just won the lottery, or you just got something new that you think is really cool. That's very, very happy. And that thing will die, or will be taken from you, or somehow you will die. And whatever, something will happen, and it'll be gone. And then you'll be very, very, very unhappy. So happiness, unhappiness does not relate to what Toi Sensei is referring to as the supreme ecstasy in any way, and the experience is not similar to happiness, what the happiness I just described. Again, you can say, well, that's semantics, but we have to choose some words to use. So it's better maybe to choose a word and then and have me try to define it for you so you know what I'm referring to with that word. Because everybody already knows these states I'm referring to, or at least is aware that the giddiness of happy birthday can't very well be the same as the supreme ecstasy. Or if you imagine that, you must be a little childish. So, yeah, if you really want to know, of course, you have to practice more, go more deeply. Maybe you already know and you just wanted to hear me say that. I'm not judging you that way, but that's the answer. Okay? Fincher?
Sensei, you were saying that to pursue the respect of others, the respect of your possessions, and the respect of things in your life is different than what you're talking about, integrity. I'm wondering about the other side of it. People that, most of us, are also looking for respect from others. So if we don't get respect from our children or from our spouse or from our boss or whatever, from our politician, we become very agitated, and it's a big problem. How is that? Is that related? Is that the same mistake?
Sure. We're all humans, and when someone disrespects us, it hurts. Right? So when we are growing up, we are taught to respect others so they will respect you. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's the golden rule. That's the way to be in society. That's the way we learn to treat others so that they will treat us. It's a very selfish motive. That's what I was detailing. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's very wise. If you insult people all the time, you're not going to be very popular. And everybody's going to be insulting you. And you're going to feel pain and hurt and unhappiness all the time until finally it's too much and you give up. So of course it's very wise to learn to respect others, all others, without preference. Whoever they are, homeless people, different races, different genders, different ages. Yes, very important to respect them. But understand why, and don't confuse that with the practice. That's the point I was trying to make. I'm not saying something's wrong with that. I'm saying don't confuse it with the practice. The practice is being true to yourself, having integrity, true to your birthright, true to what you actually are. And what is that? Is that a structural compilation of society? Is that what you really are? That's what you're being true to when you honor and respect others. Again, not wrong. Just understand what I'm saying. I'm not making judgments about these things. But it's very important to understand what we do and why we do it. Because without that, we can't discover what's left when all that is peeled away. Because if we think that's it, see, like most social structures, religious structures, teach that that's it. That's enough. But it is a belief structure that's better than other belief structures, but it's still a belief structure.
Can I ask a little bit more about that question? More specifically, with this integrity that you're speaking to, how would that change our need to be respected? How does that change? How does that...
Well, it's bordering on speculation there. But I guess I need to say something about that. And I say it's bordering on speculation because I can't really tell you. As long as we are looking for the respect of others, or relying upon it for our sense of stability, or our sense of, stability, we're bound to be disturbed, because it's bound to not come. And particularly if you're looking for it, haven't you noticed that when you're looking for respect from your partner, that's when it seems like you're not getting it? And then it gets worse and worse because you look more and more and want more and more, and it seems like more and more I'm not getting the respect I deserve or need. That's not what other people are for. Other people are a mirror for us. Toho kami eimi tame. The sharp sword of my will, I penetrate the mirror universe and polish my character like a beautiful crystal ball. If we treat them as objects, I mean, of course we refer to like treating males or females as sex objects, which is looked down upon. But hey man, we treat everybody like objects all the time. We treat each other that way all the time. Whenever we require certain things of them, they're like our puppets, and they have to jump and respond in the way that we require. This is disgusting. And yet it's our nature. I speak from experience, believe me, I know. And it's the most difficult thing to see and come to terms with because it's so painful. We wanted it from our mother, and we didn't get it because she's not perfect. She had a husband, she had other children, she had a job, whatever. And we've been seeking it the rest of our lives. Desperately seeking Susan. And that's not what other people are for. And if you think that's what they're for, you're going to be devastated. It's just one insult after another. If that's the mindset that we have. So learning, growing, maturing is learning not to treat others like that. Or even when we see ourselves doing it, to see that that's what we're doing. You know, I'm not saying you shouldn't or must not, but see what you're doing. See that. And the more you practice, the more you develop the capacity to be in awareness in the present moment, the more you can notice about your human nature. The more you'll notice about the structures, the belief structures, and the repetitive response mechanisms that you have within you. And guess what? When you're doing all that, you're not loving anybody. Not yourself, not anyone else.
You spoke about integrity and core values and how that's not really what you mean by integrity. And yet, I'd like to... When you're talking, you also talk about in the chapter about treating everything as though it's sacred. So I find a challenge between the difference of treating things... When you treat something, if I'm following your line on this, when you treat something as though it is sacred, you are treating it that way with a certain amount of, for lack of a better word, respect or integrity, because not so much because I want Jeff to respect me for the way I handled it, but if it is sacred to you, then you treat it that way because you have looked at it and decided that that is the way it should be treated in order to treat it as a sacred whatever situation or something like that. If you're doing things in that way, then they're not necessarily out of integrity, as you were talking about it, because I want somebody else to respect the way I do it. But if you're treating it that way because you have looked at it and you have decided that that is the way it should be handled, this input is coming to me, this is the way it should be handled, to treat it with as sacred, where's the difference in there? Does that make sense to you?
You described very well almost everything that I said about that in this chapter.
So I got a little thrown off about the,
well, again,
the semantics.
We're talking about the supreme ecstasy and happiness.
Right.
And in this case, we're talking about, you know, treating something as sacred, which I say is acting with integrity. And we want to be careful, though, to make sure that we're not treating something a certain way to get something in return from it.
Very true.
But that's what society calls integrity.
Okay.
Right? And so I wanted to make that distinction, that this is the integrity of practice, which has no shoulds or shouldn'ts. It has no expectation of reward. It's in toku. You can't let your right hand see what your left hand is doing, or vice versa. If you have nefarious need to get something out of your action, then your action is, well, it's not sacred in this sense. And I don't want to get too far out about this sacred idea, because people have ideas about that too. Dangerous word for me to even use there. This is a very, very difficult subject, and I think you just found that as you were like working your way through it. It's a very difficult subject to get really clear about, because our whole society has buried it for so long that for it to come out into your awareness and for you to see clearly, oh my goodness, I and everyone I respected all my life has been doing this for profit. How to be with someone and not require anything of them? Well, very, very difficult. So this whole process of practice, part of it has to be conceptual. Part of it, we have to see the difference between this. We have to see what it is that we do. Notice, I said in the chapter, the early chapter 5, first we have to notice that this is what we're doing. If we don't even notice, if we can't make that distinction between real respect and false respect, or real integrity and societally driven integrity, if we can't tell the difference between that, then we're going to be a slave to outside need. Fulfilling outside needs, solving problems outside. There's nothing wrong with solving problems, but we'll be a slave to it till we die. Everybody has to solve problems, but you do it 100% in the moment. So this is all about how to be, not what to do. How to practice, not you should do this and you shouldn't do that. Everything is okay. Everything. In according to this practice, there's no rule like that. Suzuki Sensei just constantly beat that into my head. Don't you ever tell the students they should do this or shouldn't do that. It's not about that. He didn't use the word, but he means it's amoral. It's not. There isn't a moral structure here to follow. Even though it comes up all the time in the dojo, it comes up vis-a-vis headquarters all the time, it comes up in society all the time. I mean, each of us is constantly being pressured in some way to be morally correct. As if that's part of Aikido practice. So, again, notice. In some ways, it's very good to be morally in line with the society you're in, of course. But notice what it is so that you're not a slave to it and are doing it ignorantly or delusionally.
Right. I mean, that would be kind of, you can't do it just because society says, or just because you think it's going to gain respect from somebody else. You pretty much have to do it because you have noticed it and you have decided that this is the way it should be handled.
Yeah. How to be, not what to do.
Right.
But isn't that a moral judgment, Sensei? And didn't you say this is an amoral practice? There's no way to say that one thing is better than another thing.
Yeah.
And yet, all through the evening, you've been saying that don't treat another person like an object. There seems to be, I'm not talking about the actual value, I'm talking about the fact that there seems to be a discernment about how one acts. According to this practice, there is a good. There is a good way and a not good way, and that's a judgment.
How does that What's your question?
Well, I'm seeing that, how can that be?
Can I get a
how
question
can you say this? How can you say there's no moral judgment
And
there's a better way and a not better way to be with others?
Okay, thank you. That's the question I wanted. How can I say... Did you want to answer that? No, wait, just. Did you want to say something? Okay, maybe he'll answer it for you. We'll see.
When you say moral, you're talking about choice, and the chapter says there's only one choice, to be present.
Well, let me say this about that. Yes, when you say moral, you are talking about making a choice. But when you say moral, you're talking about a choice based upon a conditioned input. In other words, when we make a moral choice, we have adopted that stance or that belief or the need to make that choice from our parents or from our church or from society or from school or somewhere. We've gotten it somewhere. When a child is born, he doesn't have any conscience. There's no superego. It's built by the society that you live in over a period of time. This is such a good question, Melly, because this is exactly what the chapter is about. In other words, this is what I've been... both with Bob and with Mark... trying to use their questions to help refine this distinction between doing something, making a judgment about something, and placing a demand upon yourself or someone else based on that judgment, and which is doing something, and just being. I suppose you can say that keeping one point, which is what I'm talking about, is a choice. I always say it's the only choice we have. But I'm not saying that there's a dark side to that. In other words, it's just like noticing. It's waking up to what's actually going on in the relative condition to these judgments that we're making. In a way, I suppose you can say, ultimately that is some kind of it's certainly a choice, and it's certainly based on experience, because the more you practice, the more you realize, oh, if I just keep one point, I won't suffer so much.
So it's good.
Well, I wouldn't use that word. It's a choice that we make. She said, so it's good. And I wouldn't use that word because it's misleading. Do you see? Because we're talking about, in other words, Toi Sensei says that the one point is like the transition between the relative and the absolute. Okay? If you use the one point as if it's a relative thing, good versus bad, then it's not one point. Because if you go look, it's not there. It doesn't exist as such. I think I'll leave you with that tonight. You can sit with that in the morning, okay? Thank you very much, everybody.